So this morning, we have our very own Jason Minix. He doesn't need an introduction. I think I've previously introduced him as the Renaissance man slash farmer slash beekeeper slash spiritual director slash just awesome person. And so this morning, he's going to be opening the scriptures with us. So let's welcome him.
I always get nervous when Gideon's going to introduce me. I don't know why. My heart rate increases and just have to remember my deep breathing. Good morning. How are y'all doing today? Good. Cool. We got more goods now. I think the coffee is flowing a little bit more through the community. So we're actually going to be looking at something that we don't talk about a whole lot as a culture, and that is grief and loss. And so I want to invite you for a minute just to think about maybe a loss that you've experienced. It could be something small, or it could be something big. And so think about what has been helpful for you in your life when you've experienced loss. Can you think of anything that you've found helpful? And if you have, you can just shout it out. God. Yeah. Most definitely. Yeah, what else? Friends. Yeah. Friends trying to make you feel better really fast. Huh? Uh-huh. I missed it. Sorry, I'm not hearing very well. I had a cold about a week ago, so I keep telling Gideon, I promise I'm not contagious. You can shake my hand. But he said maybe in 2014. Yeah. So we're good. Well, we're going to talk about loss. This is the fourth Sunday of Lent, as Gid mentioned. And we're going to look at how Jesus actually prepares for his own death. And last week, we actually looked at the same scripture that we're going to look at today. And we did Lectio, which means we open the scripture and ask God to meet us in it. And today we've really felt called to kind of go deeper into that. So I want to invite you into that today. But I want to acknowledge that it might be difficult for us to hang out there, primarily because we live in a culture that's kind of death denying in a sense, or loss denying. You know, we're kind of a culture that says, I'm okay, you're okay. When we hang out, I want you to be in a good mood so I can feel good, and I don't want you to bring me down, you know. And if things aren't going well, we need to get you better as quickly as possible because there's something really wrong with that. And so it's really different to kind of say, we're actually going to make space for loss and grief and not try to push anybody through it or speed them up, but just to say that there's something sacred that happens in that space in our lives. People used to grow up in homes where they were around death a lot more, actually. You know, a lot of times people would be surrounded by family members and extended family members. They'd be cared for by family members. And even when someone passed away, the family would have a part in preparing the body and digging the grave and doing these different things. And we don't really, you know, all of those things are things we pay other people to do now. And so we're not really faced with mortality very much. So I think it's actually kind of an uncomfortable kind of topic to bring up. So I guess I'm apologizing ahead of time for that. That's okay. I'm not sure why or what, but so we insulate ourselves, I think, from pain and dying and aging at great cost. So it might sound strange to talk about Jesus as doing grief work, but that's what we're going to do today. So grief is the natural response to any loss, and the Jewish people had and have many customs around grief work that Jesus would have been very familiar with. In fact, depending on how close you were to the person who passed, there would be a whole series of things that you would do as a way to mourn, and it would be expected of you, actually. So we're going to talk about that a little bit today. And a lot of times it's common for it to take a year to 3 years, a lot of times, to mourn the loss of someone close. So I invite you to consider today as an opportunity to make room for some kind of loss that you haven't had space for in your life. And a loss can be anything. I mean, it can be really small. It can be, remember when we moved to Oregon, we had so many changes. And it was like we lost family, we lost friends, we moved from Austin to this little tiny town where you could smell the cows from your yard. And I was like, what are we doing here? And then I remember going to the grocery store and I was just trying to find bread. I was just trying to find something familiar, comforting, and they didn't have my bread, you know, and I just stopped and I was like, oh God, they don't have the bread. You know, it was like the straw that, you know, broke my back or something, or the camel's back or whatever. I mean, I was like, everything's changed, you know, and the bread was what really, you know, pushed me over the edge. So I'm like, why am I getting emotional about bread? But I think that's, you know, those losses that can hit us around like little things all the way to larger things, including close relationships. It can be, you know, a friend, you know, loss of friendship when it changes, a change in job, loss of a sense of self. When we change in life, there are parts of ourselves we really like, and those things sometimes go away for a while, and we can really miss who we were, and I think it's good to name that. There's ways in which God changes the way he shows up in our lives, and we really like God to be predictable and to make us feel good when we reach out to him, and sometimes those things change up, and so there's a lot of times things to grieve, even in our relationship with God. I think we have loss of expectation, loss of illusions of power and control. And pretty much all change actually involves loss. So therefore, all change involves some degree of grief in the midst of it. Even if it's something you really want to have happen. You know, I find a lot of times we want these changes or these positive things and they happen. And then it's like, well, wait a minute, why am I so upset? I'm getting what I want. You know, and we can feel like we're a spoiled kid or something. And it's like, no, even though it's good stuff, it's still change. And so there's still loss that comes with it. And the scripture describes Jesus as a man of sorrows, acquainted with deep grief. And today we're going to look at some of the landscape of grief and notice how Jesus himself engages his own grieving, his own grief process. We'll look at Jesus' process through the lens of the five stages of grief. So I thought it'd be kind of neat to kind of give some landscape and some handles to what you can expect when you grieve. And those things aren't necessarily sequential, and it's not the only way to grieve. But it's just a way to know that you're not like totally crazy. It's kind of how I think of it. We're just a little bit crazy. All right, so I'm going to invite you as we look into the Word today, just to lean into Jesus's grief work today. So we're going to be in Mark chapter 14, verses 32 through 42. And I'll invite you just to read that with the people next to you, as is our practice. All right. So there's this model of grief. I'd just say a little bit about it. Was introduced by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and she was asserting that when a person or a survivor is faced with the reality of impending death or other extreme awful fate or loss, he or she will experience a series of emotional stages: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance, in no specific sequence. So these same stages are also experienced to varying degrees in any situation of change, like we mentioned before, both desirable and undesirable. Okay, so the first one is denial. I feel fine. This can't be happening, not to me. That's a very common thing in any type of change. How are you doing? Well, pretty good, you know. And it's important, actually, because it allows us to function a lot of times. Denial is usually only a temporary defense for the individual. This feeling is generally replaced with heightened awareness of possessions and individuals that will be left behind after death. Denial can be conscious or unconscious, refusal to accept facts, information, or the reality of the situation. Denial is a defense mechanism, and some people can become locked in this stage. So I think Jesus experienced denial to some degree about his fate. Even though he saw it coming, because he talked about it, he told his followers that he was going to die. I mean, he knew it was coming. But I think there was a part of him that it didn't like fully hit him. You know what I mean? Like, you can talk about a change that's coming, but it's not until it gets close, then all of a sudden you freak out. And to me, in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus is kind of freaking out a little bit. It says in verse 32, "And they came to an olive grove called Gethsemane, and Jesus said, 'Sit here while I go and pray.' He took Jesus, James, and John with him, and he began to be filled with horror and deep distress." So they came to an olive grove. I think it's important to acknowledge we need supportive environments. We need places where we feel safe in order to grieve. We also need people who can just be there and not interfere. I think it's neat that he grabbed his closest friends. You know, he took Peter, James, and John and said, "Hey, you guys come." And I think when we feel safe, when we have that support, that our grief actually just happens on its own. It's not something like you can force or make happen. And Jesus would not have found it strange to take time out and make room to mourn. In fact, in his culture, a person would spend the first week of mourning like sitting low, like on the floor. They would actually rend their garments. They would tear their clothes. And they wouldn't be allowed to do regular things to kind of keep up appearances. Like, they would be expected to be in this place, not allowed to cook for themselves for the first 3 days at least. So it's a really powerful kind of cultural expectation that you would just make space for this, and that would be very normal for him to take time to make room for this sense of loss that he was feeling already. The second stage of grief is anger. Why me? It's not fair. How can this happen to me? Who is to blame? Once in the second stage, the individual recognized the denial cannot continue. Because of anger, the person is very difficult to care for due to misplaced feelings of rage and envy. Yes, that's hard. Anger can manifest itself in different ways. People can be angry with themselves, with others, especially those who are close to them. It's important to remain detached and non-judgmental when dealing with a person experiencing anger from grief. In verse 34, Jesus told them, "My soul is crushed with grief to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me." He went on a little farther and fell to the ground. He prayed that if it were possible, the awful hour awaiting him might pass by. "Abba, Father," he cried out, "everything is possible for you. Please take this cup of suffering away from me. Yet I want your will to be done, not mine." Then he returned and found the disciples asleep. He said to Peter, "Simon, are you asleep? Couldn't you watch with me even 1 hour? Keep watch and pray so that you will not give in to temptation, for the spirit is willing, but the body is weak." I think oftentimes when we grieve, we get angry and can easily take it out on ourselves and those close to us. And I think this is part of Jesus' response. I mean, he told him, my soul is crushed with grief to the point of death. And all he asked him to do is just stay here and keep watch with me. It seems simple. And I'm sure they're like, okay, sure, we'll hang out, whatever. This is probably another one of those things Jesus is trying to teach us something or whatever. And they, you know, I don't think they understand the importance of presence, really, because they're thinking, well, we'll just listen for danger, probably, right? So if we fall asleep, no big deal. We'll hear something coming and feel like we're doing our part. So Jesus asked them just to do these two simple things, just stay here and pray. And they didn't do it, you know, and it's like in his hour of need, he's coming back, and if you can just imagine his frustration, like, guys, come on, I just wanted you to do this little thing for me. So he's kind of in a, you know, in a kind of a weird spot with it. I remember when I was actually a freshman in college, my dad passed away suddenly, and it kind of sent me into a tailspin in a lot of ways. But when I started to actually engage grief work, I remember it was also kind of when I found community for the first time. And there were so my grief work stuff was such I couldn't really contain it. So I kept trying to like go away and hide and deal with it on my own because I was embarrassed. But then people would like follow me. And I can think of like several people where I'm like crying and I'm putting snot like all over their shoulder. Like I have this impression of that. And you know, I just think about the power of being present for each other when we go through difficult things, when we process loss. It doesn't take any special words or any special thing to say. It's a lot of times just staying there, just being close by. In verse 37, he returned and found the disciples asleep. He said to Peter, Simon, are you asleep? Couldn't you watch with me even 1 hour? Keep watch and pray. Have you ever been in a position where you had to teach someone what you need? I had that same kind of experience like Jesus, like I have this need and I have to teach them how to be there for me and they're still not doing it. So you can imagine he might be a little frustrated. So fast forward a little bit, when I actually went into seminary a few years later, I had gotten married, had a little son, and I was in class and another piece of this grief work came up for me. And I was like, oh, this small class, 20, 25 people, not going to do this in front of these people I don't know. So I'm like, and then the teacher's like, oh, by the way, we're going to get into small groups later. And I'm like, yep, I'm gone. So I left, went downstairs, and there's like this little chapel. And I got down there, and this was the way a lot of it was for me, is that I would try to do my work on my own, and then I wouldn't be able to get there. Like, I'd be like, God, really? Like, I'm finally alone. Nobody's going to see me. And so invariably, after about 10 minutes, my small group came down to look for me because they were worried. And they said, hey, Jason, we don't know you very well. Are you doing okay? I said, no, I'm not. I said, I need to talk to people, and you're the people. But I don't need you to say anything. Like, I don't want you to say anything back to me. And they're like, okay. And I say, okay, but listen, I'm probably going to get emotional and I might cry. And I'm like, is that cool? And they're like, yeah, that's fine. So I shared my piece. I cried. I felt a lot better. I felt peace. I felt healing. And then, you know, the guy there was like, can I say something? I'm like, at this point, I'm feeling better, and I'm thinking, you know, what's the worst that can happen? So I'm like, sure, go ahead, you know. So he says something. I'm sure it was fine. I don't know what it was. And he's like, is that okay? And I'm like, yeah, that was okay. To be honest, it didn't do anything. Like, it didn't help me at all. I kind of felt obligated to let you share something because, like, I mean, I know this sounds terrible, doesn't it? It's terrible. But I was like, yeah, I just feel like, you know, you gave me something, I want to give you something back. And he's like, okay, that's fair. You know, we went on our way. So anyway, I feel like maybe Jesus was in this place where he's trying to teach people what he needs while he's trying to manage this, you know, this need he has to process this. So the third kind of, or another part of, I guess, grief work is bargaining that can show up. Again, Some of these things don't show up for us. Sometimes they do in just different ways or different names. So it's not like a, you know, it's not a line necessarily. I'll do anything for a few more years. I'll give up my life savings if the third stage involves the hope that the individual can somehow postpone or delay death. Usually the negotiation for an extended life is made with a higher power in exchange for a reformed lifestyle. You know, God, I'll start living right if you'll just save this person or me or, you know, or change this. Psychologically, the individual is saying, I understand I will die, but if I could just do something to buy more time. People facing less serious trauma can bargain or seek to negotiate a compromise. For example, can we still be friends when facing a breakup? Bargaining rarely provides a sustainable solution, especially if it's a matter of life or death. So a lot of times it's like, you know, the dog dies, let's go buy a new dog. It's like, well, wait a minute, we got to grieve for a while. You know, relationship ends. Well, let's keep it going in another way. Well, let it die, which is hard to say. We're going to let the relationship die. And then if something is reborn out of it, that's great. But let's give it time. Let's give ourselves space to actually kind of experience it. Jesus says in verse 36, Abba, Father, he cried out, everything is possible for you. Please take this cup of suffering away from me, yet I want your will to be done, not mine. Abba, Father, Dad. God is such an incredible resource for grieving, and that's what I found. I realized I've got to go through this. I've got to find a way to deal with this regardless. So I could do this on my own, or I could do it with God. I'm like, well, I could use some help, you know. So just this sense of God, and this is Jesus' vision of who God is and our vision of who God is, that God so wants to walk with us in every aspect of our life, is not intimidated by the intensity of what we feel and go through. And so that's, I think that's such a powerful thing, that it helps us to be able to engage the more difficult parts of our life. Jesus says, everything is possible for you. Please take this cup of suffering away from me. Is there another way? I think we get stuck here a lot, seeking another way, don't we? I think we have this sense that we don't want to feel bad. We want to feel good. And it's very weird to say, I'm going to make space to feel like crap, maybe for a while. And that's okay. So we seek a lot of ways around our suffering, and we seek a lot of ways around just letting grief move through us and overwhelm us at times. But if we hang out and we wait, it does move through. It does pass. Actually, I have a really kind of weird, gross metaphor for this. It's kind of like throwing up. It's like, when you've got something you just got to deal with, it's like the closer it gets, the worse you feel. But as soon as you get something up, you're just like, oh, I'm so glad I did that, you know? So, you know, you don't want it for its own sake, but you're like relieved. So it's kind of like that. So it's like, I don't think grieving is like something where like, man, I can't wait till I get to grieve again. Can't wait till I get to be sick again. So that's another kind of phase in is depression. I'm so sad, you know, why bother with anything? You can be totally exhausted. I think that's another piece that comes with change and loss, is you can just feel completely worn out. I'm going to die soon. What's the point? I miss my loved one. Why go on? During the fourth stage, the dying person begins to understand the certainty of death. Because of this, the individual may become silent, refuse visitors, spend much of the time crying and grieving. You don't always cry when you grieve. That's the other thing I should say. There are a lot of ways to grieve, and it's every person's process with it's different. So if you feel like you haven't cried enough or at all, it doesn't mean you're not grieving. So sometimes you just might get irritable or other things, but this process allows the dying person to disconnect from things of love and affection. It is not recommended to attempt to cheer up an individual who is in this stage. You can try. it doesn't work very well. It is an important time for grieving that must be processed. Depression could be referred to as the dress rehearsal for the aftermath. It is a kind of acceptance with emotional attachment. It's natural to feel sadness, regret, fear, uncertainty when going through this stage. Feeling those emotions shows that the person has begun to accept the situation. In verse 33, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him, and he began to be filled with horror and deep distress. He told them, "My soul is crushed with grief to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me." Filled with horror and deep distress. I think this is the scariest part of grief work, because it overwhelms you. And it can feel like, if I let this overwhelm me, if I let the gorilla out of the closet kind of thing, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm going to lose control, or I don't know if I'll be able to recover. And that is like every time. And it's also one of those things that it's never as bad when you finally do it. But the build up to that, I feel that every time still. My soul is crushed with grief to the point of death. It can feel like we're going to die. Like, worst time, you know, throwing up's right before you heave, right? And it's interesting. What's really counterintuitive is that the best thing you can do, it's like you can go lay in bed for hours and it'll take a half day longer. You can go sit on the cold tile and it'll come up a lot quicker. I mean, I actually find it's helpful to follow the nerve of the pain. To actually, when I was working through grief with my dad, I would actually take time, actually put on melancholy Sarah McLachlan music. And I know. No judgment. Don't judge me. You can't judge me. Got my journal out. I was like, I'm going to grieve. You know, and it actually asks the question, what am I missing most right now? What's the hardest part? What's the thing that I, you know, the scariest part of this? And actually kind of find the nerve of it and get there. So, yeah, it's not very counterintuitive. And there are a lot of artists you can call on in those times. This is labeled depression. It's not the same as clinical depression. So there's elements of grief in depression and vice versa. But I think there's types of depression where you need medication to work through. What I find with grief work is that it's common to wonder if you need it. And I just kind of like to say, a lot of times when you're engaging that work and you have support, you know, you don't need that. But some do, and that's fine too. So again, it's just, but it's not exactly the same as like clinical depression. It's easy to get stuck, though, I find, in catharsis. So one of the things I found was I got into this loop of like, okay, I'm feeling really terrible. I probably need some grief work. So schedule a date with Sarah and, you know, work on this. And I got kind of stuck in this pattern for a while of just getting stuck in melancholy. And that wasn't the same as healing work. So at some point, that work, it's not a place to stay. I mean, grief work can't give you life. And that's where we move out and re-engage the world. And that's this fifth part of these grief stages. They talk about acceptance. It's going to be okay. I can't fight it. I may as well prepare for it. In this last stage, individuals begin to come to terms with their mortality, or that of a loved one, or other tragic event. The stage varies according to the person's situation. People dying can enter this stage a long time before the people they leave behind, who must pass through their own individual stages of dealing with grief. So in verse 41, Jesus says, when he returned to them, or scripture says, the third time he said, go ahead and sleep, have your rest. But no, the time has come. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Up, let's be going. Look, my betrayer is here. So go ahead and sleep. How can you tell when grief work is kind of winding down? Well, I think when you don't get as hurt or angry with other people, you know, it's not as touchy. I think that's a good indicator. And Jesus says the time has come. So I think there's a way in which we can kind of face the change and engage life again. You know, it's when you remember that person or that thing you miss and it feels different. That's when you can tell that grief work is happening in a lot of ways. This is usually the time, too, we start to feel some meaning about our loss. usually when we have loss, we want the meaning right away. Give it to me now. Give it to me yesterday, actually. And so a lot of times we're open to other people's epiphanies about loss and whatnot. And the problem is that they're usually like ash in our mouth. They usually don't really help us very much, because there's a way in which when we move through our own process, there's a meaning that's indigenous to our experience. There's a way in which God meets us in our experience and reveals things to us that nobody else can outside of it. So a lot of times we're looking for these answers, or people assume we are, or we're giving our answers that we've come to through doing our grief work, but usually they don't help very much. And so maybe just an invitation to distrust a little bit, you know, your own willingness, our own willingness to be helpful, because it feels benevolent. It feels like we want to alleviate suffering as though, you know, it were a negative thing. So we can also distrust our value judgments about suffering sometimes too. Well, I find this is not a very cheery ending. You know, it's like Jesus is doing this grief process and he's like, okay, now I'm ready. I'm being betrayed. Woohoo! But I think it's honest, because it's what happened. But I think when we're called into these kind of difficult seasons, it's just kind of this reminder God doesn't give us this get out of suffering free card. So just like kind of, I guess I'm in the habit of sharing a story about my daughter and I at the end of, when I speak here for some reason. But we lost a little dog about 4 or 5 months ago. His name was Razzle. So it was really sad. We were on a walk and he ran off through a field and got hit by a car. And this is a horrible day. Terrible. Like, yeah, it was really bad. And kids were crying. I'm like, don't know what to do and all this. And so after that, my daughter, like for about 2 or 3 months, didn't want to go on walks, especially at night. Didn't want to take the other dogs. Didn't want me to go on walks without her, with the dogs especially. And so we had this kind of series, a lot of time of talking and processing and doing a lot of grief work around this dog. And finally, one night we were out. This is a couple of weeks ago. We were just taking a walk and we had the dogs, and my daughter was actually, her name is Grace, was pretty light and fun, and we're holding hands and talking. And she says, Dad, I can't wait to see Razzle in heaven. And I said, well, me too. And we're not going to talk about whether dogs go to heaven or not. You just, in case you're wondering, you just say yes, yes. Just go with it. And then she says, and I can't wait to meet Jim, your dad also. She calls my dad Jim, never got to meet him. And I said, yeah, I'm really looking forward to that as well. And then she just looked at me and she said, Dad, I hope heaven's real. And I said, yeah, me too, you know. And I was just struck in that moment that she's receiving all the comfort of God in heaven without really being 100% certain if it's actually there. And I thought, how cool is that? That hope and faith aren't about certainty. I mean, they're about the leaning in. That when we lean into this kind of ocean of God's love, we're changed and comforted regardless of how sure of it we are, or how sure we are of what's to come. That we each have to walk this road. So why not receive a little bit of help from God and community? And I really am kind of struck by that still, because I feel like sometimes children are teaching us, you know, how to be human in a sense. So anyway, that's the closing from my daughter. I invite you to pray with me.